history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be told. And we're never going to know unless we take a little initiative. The idea, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and in the process, to learn a lot. We're continually educated, entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. They're all so meaningful, they all add to our perspective, and when it comes to our view of freedom, the stories from ex-prisoners of war, those that had to live in the absence of freedom, can really jolt our reality. That was the case for me when I first met Jack Schwartz, who spent more time as a prisoner in World War II than America actually spent at war. Not long after interviewing Jack on Hometown Heroes, I received an odd-shaped package in the mail. Inside, a beautiful wooden bowl he had turned on his lathe, a skill he continued to practice until he was 102. I watched Jack fly out on an honor flight to Washington, D.C., grinning ear to ear as the assembled crowd sent him off with a special serenade on his 99th birthday. I got to see that same smile when he cut birthday cake with his fellow ex-prisoners of war for birthdays 100, 101, 102, and 103. And I was with him less than 2 months ago for National POW MIA Recognition Day. He was one of those people you almost expect to live forever and have an active, involved life forever. And he almost did, really. Jack passed away November 7th at the age of 103, and today's program is dedicated to him. Before we hear some of his World War II story, let's hear from his son, Jack Schwartz Jr.
Well, I'm going to remember the fact that he was a really, really good father growing up, but he never talked about his younger years very much. I knew, of course, he went to Caltech and stories about that, but he really never talked about his time as a POW when I was growing up. And because he lived so long, you know, back 30 years ago, after he retired, he started opening up about it. And he started getting involved with ex-POW functions and American Defenders of Bataan Corregidor functions, which I never knew about. He started telling me about them. And then when we went to Japan in 2014, that's when I found out that he had a diary that he had transcribed. And I read it on the way over. And listening to my dad during that week in Japan, together with the other prisoners of war, really allowed us to get closer than just a parent-child type of thing growing up. So I was really fortunate that he lived as long as he did. Somebody asked me if I had any gripes against my dad, and the answer is absolutely not. How can you have a gripe against somebody who had such an amazing life and who was such a good father?
That is Jack Schwartz Jr. talking about his late father, who we're going to listen back to now. Jack's story began in San Francisco less than a decade after the devastating 1906 earthquake, which his mother had survived.
She told me about it. They had to live in Golden Gate Park for quite a while, but that's not all she ever told me.
And I hear you were quite the whiz kid, huh?
Meaning what?
You were extremely intelligent.
Well, I guess so, because back in those days, they didn't have kindergarten, so I was learning at home. And finally, my father insisted that I get into school before I was six, even though six was the usual time. So they put me in the first grade, and 2 weeks later, they put me in the second grade. So I guess that indicates something. I actually don't remember learning to read at home, but I must have, obviously.
Yeah, that's got to be a record for the shortest time spent in first grade there. That's pretty impressive. But as a young boy, something you had to deal with very early on, and you dealt with plenty in World War II, but I guess the first big thing that you had to deal with was the death of your father when you were just 10 years old?
Yeah, I was 10 when he died. Very suddenly, had a heart attack, fell right over, and that was it. So after we got over that, my mother and a sister from Seattle moved down to Los Angeles. Actually, we lived in Hollywood. I went to LeConte Junior High School and Hollywood High School. I got out of Hollywood High School when I was just 15.
How'd you pull that off? 15 years and a high school graduate. How'd you do that?
Well, actually, this is funny, too. I was still in San Francisco. I was in the sixth grade, and the same teacher taught the seventh grade. So she said, let's skip the sixth and go to the seventh. So I was never in the first or sixth grade, really. Uh-huh. That's how it came about. Actually, I think it's much better now. They give higher rated courses to people that are ahead of time instead of skipping. Your social life is actually followed up. When you're in high school and you're 15, you're graduating. I never went to a prom, for instance. So it was good, but it had its drawbacks, too.
It sounds like you had an interest at a very young age in being an engineer. Is that something that there was a moment you remember where that really became clear in your mind, that you had an ability in that direction?
I don't recall the exact time. It was early on. I think, like most boys, I wanted to be a farmer when I was a kid, a fireman. I got over that, but I forget. I was still in high school when I decided to take up civil engineering. And my original thought was to go to UC Berkeley because they have a very good engineering school there. But I still remember it was sort of funny because we took my final exam in trigonometry while I was in high school. I got 100%. The teacher wrote good. So I went to him and said, what do you have to do to be better than good? So I said, Jack, you're pretty smart, but I don't think you're smart enough to get into Caltech. I'd never even thought about going to Caltech, but that was a challenge. So I took up the challenge and got admitted to Caltech. In those days, they didn't have the SAT. That didn't exist then. So those that applied had to go over to Pasadena, take 2 8-hour days of testing, and they picked out the top 160 because that was the class size. And I was selected. So I guess my math teacher was wrong. But that's the reason I went, practically why I got interested there. I'm glad I did.
So you were at Caltech at age 15?
Well, actually, before school started, I turned 16. Probably the youngest one of the class. And it's not an easy school, I'll tell you that. But I worked hard, had good memories of it. I got out in 1935, and things were all that middle of the Depression, really. So I stayed on for another year to get a master's degree. They gave me a teaching fellowship, so I got free tuition, which wasn't a big deal, but the tuition in those days was $100 a quarter. That's how times change. The summer after my bachelor's degree, four of the civil engineering students and our surveying professor went to Palomar Mountain, and we surveyed the top of the mountain where the telescope is now. So that was my first engineering check, and it was signed by Robert Millikan, the head of Caltech. I wish I had it, but they didn't have Xeroxes in those days either.
So you guys did the surveying so they could construct that big observatory on top of Palomar Mountain.
Yeah, we did. I suspect now with all the techniques they have, they can do it better in an hour probably, but sometimes change.
When did it occur to you that joining the Navy and being an engineer for the Navy was a good idea?
It's another funny one. I was working for the Division of Highways up in Northern California, and out of the clear blue, I got a letter from the Navy asking if I was interested in joining the Navy Civil Engineering Corps as an ensign. It sounded all right, so I said yes and applied, and then it came back and said, sorry, you're too young. So that was that. You had to be, I think, 24, and I was 21. And the next year, I said, well, they wrote me another letter. I said the same thing. Meantime, I changed jobs, so another opportunity came up with the Army Engineers, which was really a very good job. I moved down to Los Angeles and worked for the Army Engineers there. They were designing the linings for the L.A. River. Back then, the L.A. River was just open on all sides. Anytime it was it flooded all over the place. And they were designing these concrete walls, which you can see now. And I worked out in a laboratory in Griffith Park where we tested their designs. I really did enjoy that job. Then I saw this ad, I forget where, that the Navy was recruiting civil engineers again. You could apply for that. Well, at that time I was 24. This sounds funny. So I did apply for it and gave my background. You had to go clear back to Washington, D.C. at your own expense to take the test, which I did. I think they said there were 5 openings and they had screened everybody out. And 55 applicants were back there in Washington. So they called us in and said, well, you know, there's 55 of you here. We've screened you. You're all good. But there's only 5 appointments. How about joining the reserves? So I said, fine. Everybody said fine, I think. Guess what? I'm a year too young. You had to be 25 to be a reserve civil engineer. But here I was, 24, applying for Lieutenant JG, which is the next step up. So I said, you know, this is funny. How about a waiver? They gave me a waiver. So here again, I was the youngest civil engineer, JG, in the Corps, and I did join up. And it was in July of 40 that I got to tell her, I ask her, and I quote this, I still remember it. Will you accept duty at Pearl Harbor in the 14th Naval District? So I looked that up. Sounded great. I mean, who doesn't want to go to Hawaii? So I said, fine, and I accepted. And a lot of funny things happened after that.
Well, and a lot of not-so-funny things, too, by the time World War II was over, and you had no idea what you were in store for. But what happened next? After you accepted that appointment, did they actually take you to Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I had duty at Pearl Harbor. I got there in September of 1940 and started duty there. Actually, we were looking at the whole island, because all the Navy construction on all the islands, but the office was at Pearl Harbor.
And what kind of work were you doing? What kind of things, projects?
All of the projects were being built by civilian engineers. And the Navy was just in charge of the construction, overseeing, seeing they did the projects right and stuff like that. Actually, at Pearl Harbor, I was not involved in any really big projects, just a bunch of little projects. That was going along fine. I was married. I shipped my wife over, and we were enjoying life in Honolulu. Everybody said, don't turn the island too fast because you're going to be here a long time. Well, I wasn't there a long time. Suddenly, they said, you're being transferred to Guam. I didn't know that once they got in the Navy, they could do what they wanted. I found out the hard way. So we moved out to Guam in January of 41, and life was pretty simple there. In fact, I think there were more ox carts than there were automobiles. I'm not joking. It was really a backward place.
More ox carts, is that what you said, than automobiles?
Yeah, that's what I said.
I'm curious at this point, and you've got your wife with you in Guam. You're a young married couple. Did you have a sense, an awareness, an anticipation that war might be coming?
At the time, no, but later on, in October of 41, they shipped all the families home. And that's sure, that was a wake-up call. Yeah. In other words, the government was sure there was going to be a war, even though there wasn't.
But that didn't occur to you at the time?
Well, it did when they shipped the families home, sure.
So in October of 41, your wife gets sent back to the States and you're left on Guam. That had to be difficult for you.
Well, it wasn't all that difficult, but the only women left there were five Navy nurses, and they left one wife there, didn't get shipped back, and she was something like 8 months pregnant. They didn't want her on the ship, so when the war started, she was captured along with the rest of us.
So on Guam, I would assume that similar to at Pearl Harbor, your job would entail designs and construction projects there on Guam to build infrastructure for the Navy and other branches?
That's exactly right. The big project we had was a new breakwater for Apra Harbor. It's a beautiful harbor now, but it was unprotected from storms. And the biggest project we had was building the breakwater, which, of course, was not finished when I was there. It was finished eventually. Designed some houses, swimming pools, bleachers for ball games. Practically nothing in the way of defense. In fact, there were no defense projects going on. Congress back then didn't want to upset the Japanese, and they gave no money to Guam for any defenses. Sounds funny now, doesn't it? But anyhow, that's the way it was.
Would you say that in this period, what, about a year and a half that you were in the service before the war started, that it was a bit of an adventure for you, that you were seeing parts of the world and feeling fulfilled in your work and a pretty carefree existence?
Actually, I was very happy there. It was easy living and happy about work. Yeah, it was very good. The war hadn't started, it would have been great, but it did start.
And when did you catch wind of that? What happened on Guam? What was the atmosphere there on December 7th, 1941?
Well, actually, it was December 8th, 1941. I crossed the date line.
Good point. So December 8th on Guam, December 7th in Honolulu.
That's right. The first thing we knew was, after my wife went home, another civil engineer moved in with me in the same house. We had a maid and cook for $25 a month, you can imagine. But anyhow, we got a call about 5 in the morning. Not we, but the headquarters got a call from Pearl Harbor saying hostilities have started. Those were the words. Then I found out they didn't say a Pearl Harbor event attack, but they found that out real quick. So everybody on staff got called. We rushed down to headquarters to see the captain, who was also the governor of the island. The defense plans for Guam, it was called the Rainbow Plan in those days, was just to do nothing. We were meant to surrender. There were no defenses. There were 100 Marines on the island, but they were mostly policemen for the island. So we knew we'd be captured at that point, just a matter of when. And for a couple of days, they sent planes over Guam and dropped a few bombs. there was a minesweeper called the Penguin, and they sank that, and a number of officers that were killed on that. And on shore, I'm not sure anybody was killed by the bombing. A few people were hurt. All we could do in the civil engineering was destroy all the equipment that was being used to construct the breakwaters. There was huge construction equipment. We blew out the motors and stuff on that.
So it wouldn't be used against you?
Yeah, so it could be used by the Japanese. They probably could have put new motors in, but at least we did what we could.
I know this was a long time ago, but your memory clearly is very sharp. Most people haven't been in that position where they find out that in a major way it's hopeless. There's no chance of not getting captured, that this is inevitable. But how did you deal with that as a young man with your wife back in the States to have that realization, you know what, I'm going to become a prisoner of the Japanese or die trying not to be? How did you handle that and process that at the time?
We were all just in a hell of a spot and with nothing we could do. Yeah, we used to joke before that about eating rice and fish heads. We didn't realize we wouldn't get the fish when we go to Japan. But I can't recall any special thoughts on it.
Do you think it was a blessing or a curse to know in advance before you were captured that that was going to happen? Do you think it helped prepare you for it, that you had a little advance understanding of what was about to happen?
No, I don't think so, because we had no idea what it was like to be a prisoner. When the Japs did come in, they landed on a couple of beaches. There were nobody defending the beaches. This was all in the dark. It was early in the morning. And I was in my office in the same building that they had. It was called the Plaza. It was an old Spanish building, because you probably know the Spanish had the island before, up until 1898, when the U.S. took it over after the Spanish-American War. Typical Spanish construction. The walls were about 3 feet thick. And my office was down there on the ground floor. Japanese troops finally came to the plaza. It was a group of Chamorros who were there for the island patrol under the command of a Navy chief. And they were set up on the plaza with a machine gun from World War I, I'm sure. We started hearing firing, not an awful lot. And finally it stopped, and we stayed quiet. It was still dark, and I wasn't about to walk out and see what was happening. And it turned out, I know this for a fact, that the governor sent the executive officer down to offer a surrender. They made him drop his trousers and everything, stand there naked, but he did surrender. I'm sure a lot went out there. I've read about what out there in the plaza, but I didn't witness it because I was literally hiding until it was light. Anyhow, I came out with light with my hands up, and there they were. All the prisoners were all rounded up, Japanese Marines. These were not kids. These were experienced soldiers. You might remember, maybe you don't, the Japanese started war in 1932 in Manchuria and in China. So they had very experienced troops. They saw us come out and they stopped. In my pocket, I had a 5-inch slide rule. Nobody uses slide rules anymore. And this fellow took it out of his rack, looked at it, put it back in my pocket, saw my watch, didn't take my watch, and just rounded us up. Later on, they moved us all to a Catholic church. And that's where they kept us the month we were on Guam.
That would be the first of 45 months that Jack Schwartz would spend as a prisoner of war. He would mark his next 4 birthdays in captivity. Jack passed away November 7th at the age of 103, and we honor his legacy on a weekend in which he'll be buried at Santa Nella National Cemetery. We'll hear Jack's POW story and more from his son Jack Jr. when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to celebrate a unique man with an incredible life story. Jack Schwartz passed away November 7th at the age of 103, but there were days as a prisoner of war when he wasn't sure he'd make it to 27. Those POW days remained a mystery to his family for decades. His son, Jack Jr., really didn't know any details about his dad's captivity until a trip back to Japan in 2015 to visit some of those prison camps. His then 99-year-old father handed him a typed transcription of the diary he had kept as a prisoner.
Yeah, I was reading it for the first time, and you know, I learned a lot of things, like he raised rabbits, which they would then eat, you know, because they're references to bunny burgers occasionally. He never talked about his experiences. He always downplayed things in terms of the physical nature of the camp. And of course, he was an officer, so he did not have to do a lot of the slave labor. But like at the Kawasaki 2B camp, he was a senior officer. So if something went wrong in the camp, he was the one who was dragged in front of the guards and the prisoners and beaten up. He always did say that two things. One, that he always considered himself to be a lucky POW because he didn't have to go through a lot of things that the enlisted men did in terms of the slave labor and the mines and the stevedores and whatnot. But he also made the point that he never saw the torture that have been reported at other camps. He made a very strong point of that, that while there was malnutrition, horrible living conditions, there was never the torture that is so prominent in many of the stories. So he considered himself very lucky.
What does that make you consider yourself, knowing what he had to endure and overcome for you to ever come into existence?
Well, that's true. If he hadn't survived, I wouldn't have been here.
No, and so many of us listening right now can apply that same dynamic to our existence, whether our ancestors were POWs or just in combat or harm's way in other manners. That is Jack Schwartz Jr., and we're going to hear more from him at the end of the program, but let's hear more from his dad's original interview about how he handled the uncertainty of indefinite imprisonment by the Japanese.
We never thought that we would win a war eventually, even though things were bad, and we didn't know how long it would take. The Japanese called it a 100 Years' War because what they called it the Eastern China Co-Prosperity Sphere. That's what they called it, and which meant that they were going to take over China and all the Orient, really. And we knew it would be that long, obviously. But there was no idea of how long it would take. But a number of the younger fellows, this was while we were prisoner, a number of the younger fellows did get discouraged is the word. And I think some died from discouragement. I really do. Because we all had the same amount of food, and some just sort of gave up. In one of the camps I was at, I was in Yokohama for 2 years after, not at first. We lost about one man a month. I think just from discouragement. They had to work, but they all worked. The officers, incidentally, were not put to work. I think that's the only thing of the Geneva Conference the Japs honored. I never knew why, but they did. They made us promise not to escape. Well, that was easy. Where we could escape to another island. Actually, it would have been easy to escape from the camp. But where do you go? You're an American in Japan. Who's not going to recognize you? And a few people did try to escape. They got caught the next day and brought back. Then the whole camp suffered. We had to stand at attention for all night long or something like that.
You mentioned guys dying from discouragement. So that begs the question, what kept you encouraged? What helped you believe that you would survive, that you would get home to see your wife again?
I'm not sure. I just think we have faith that we'd get recaptured. I mean, there's no doubt about it, we'd win the war eventually. As I've said, fortunately, I was not ever really sick, and we all lost weight, but we all wanted more food, but it wasn't to the point where we emaciated, so just had faith, that was all.
And I want to talk to you about some of the conditions of the camps you're in and the way you were treated and what you had to eat and all that. But as far as communicating with your wife back home, was there a point at which you were able to get a letter to her and vice versa? Or were you guys without communication that whole time?
No, actually, we did get to, it was 3 or 4 months after we were captured that the U.S. was notified who the prisoners were. So at least the family knew I was alive. It was quite a bit of time after that when we were each allowed to write a postcard home, which of course was censored, but anyhow, we did write home. And in the course of the whole war, I probably wrote 4 or 5 postcards and got a few letters. I got one package from home. That was about the extent of communication. At least I knew we were alive.
I would imagine, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or impose my own understanding on yours, but I would imagine when you're a prisoner on the other side of the world and you've been a prisoner so long that getting a package from home had to be a real serious highlight for you.
Well, sure as heck was. It had food mostly, and basically food. They knew that's what we needed. It only happened once. I think they sent more, but I never got them. And the Red Cross sent packages now and then, but in my almost four years, I got one package. And there were more deaths. The gems was confiscated, that was all. When we got the package, of course, it was a big deal. It had, among other things, butter and jam and some meat. And of all things, a package of cigarettes. And I don't smoke then. I didn't smoke now. And so trading went on. I traded a pack of cigarettes for a jar of jam, as I recall it. There wasn't all that much communication, but it was good having even some.
And I'm sure that each camp was different. But when you think back on it all that time, what were the most difficult things that you had to deal with? Were you treated well? Were you abused? How would you describe the way you were handled as a prisoner by your Japanese captors?
Well, the first camp at Sensuji turned out to be just an officer's camp. And the Japanese used that for their show camp. If the Red Cross wanted to inspect a Japanese POW camp, they went to Sensuji. It was practically a country club compared to other camps. So there you have to say that outside of not eating enough, we were not abused, really. In fact, they tried to teach us Japanese, but they gave up after a while. Of course, we learned some things. You had to count off ichi, ni, san, chi, and so forth. And we learned the commands, turn right, turn left, sit down, you know, things like that. And a little Japanese. But here's something that's interesting. Once in a while, we got Japanese newspapers printed in English. Of course, this was near the beginning of the war. The Japs were winning all over the place. But we got the news anyway. And even a couple of years later, when I got back to Sensuji, we got 1 or 2 copies. And by then, of course, they were losing the war, and their reporting was quite a bit different. But all in all, I've said ever since I came back that as POWs go, I was a very lucky POW. I was beaten a few times at Kawasaki because I was the senior officer there. And if anything went wrong, they blamed me. And I'd get beaten around the face. Not wounded, really, just beaten up till you fall down and they stop. But the interesting thing is that the Japanese beat their own soldiers. A corporal could beat up a private. Just a different culture, that's all. So I'll say again, not only lucky to get back, I was lucky the way I was treated, really.
Because, in general, Japanese prisoners of the Japanese in World War II had a lot rougher circumstances, in most cases, than prisoners of the Germans did. But you look at even the longest held POW of the war in Japan, you feel like you were fortunate over there. Were you aware that others in Japanese captivity were being treated in worse shape than you were?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we got stories about them. And, of course, I've read many stories about them since then. This was not in Sensuji, but I went to Kawasaki after about 6 months, along with the other 2 civil engineers from Guam, and we never knew why. And we guess it was because they shipped some Navy machinists up there. Maybe they thought engineers were machinists. Anyhow, when we got up, they said, oh, it's a mistake. We'll send you back. Well, they sent my friend Frank back after a year, and they sent me back after 2 years, and the third one stayed there through the whole war, and he was killed by American planes about 2 weeks before the war was over. I mean, bomb had hit the camp. So he lived through the whole war, never got home. So as I say, here I was lucky.
And I imagine when you hear a story like that, when you get that news, there's part of you that says, hey, that could have been me.
Well, sure, it could have been. Here's the other thing I was about to tell you. Up at this camp in Kawasaki, we had an English doctor. He was in the English Navy. How he got there is a different story, which he don't want to know about. But he treated the American prisoners, and he got beat up more than I did because he kept on trying to get prisoners' excuse of going to work. If he tried so hard, he'd get beaten up. He still kept it up. He lived through the war, and later on in 1946, I sent him packages because in England they were really hard up for months after the war was over. So he got care packages from me as a return favor. But as I say, I've always said I was lucky.
You wouldn't recommend being a POW for almost 4 years?
That's exactly right.
But that said, I imagine there's a lot of perspective that you've carried forward in your life that you wouldn't have if you had not endured all those years without the freedom that you treasure so much now.
I think so, because things that many people take real serious, and by comparison, they're not serious. And that's been my attitude really long.
Did you ever make friends with any of the Japanese guards or soldiers or officers?
Yes, I did. We had an interpreter at this second cabin in Kawasaki. I forget his first name. His name was Kondo. And we got quite friendly, really. And in fact, he treated us pretty well. We talked, and I had learned in prison camp to do a macrame. I don't know if you know what that is.
Sure.
We got a hold of the string, and I was making macrame wristbands. And the Kondo says, "Hey, make me one." I said, "Well, what are you going to do for me?" And I knew what I wanted. I had seen in the paper that some bookstore was selling American books on calculus, and I wanted that.
You wanted a you're in captivity. Your wife's back in the States. You barely have anything to eat, and what you want to trade for is a calculus book?
Well, what else I could trade for? So I did, and he got it for me, and I worked every problem in the book. I should have saved the book, but I have a good habit. But it helped pass the time. Actually, in my situation, it was border more than anything else, because the officers didn't have to go to work. But what else was there to do? You sat around. There were only six of us there.
And when you say some guys died from discouragement, that was probably it, that their minds and that idleness went to that place, and you found some more constructive and productive things to do inside your head.
Well, actually, it was the enlisted men who were at work that died. Interesting thing, though, you would talk about attitudes. 1 year to date after the war was over, two of my friends committed suicide, two that had been in camp with me. So it did have a lasting effect on a lot of people. One was living in a room with me. He was a master sergeant from the Philippines. And the other was a Lieutenant J.G., who was captain in Guam, a very wealthy young man, too, incidentally. They committed suicide a year later, so it must have weighed on him very heavily. I was over it by then.
How'd you do that?
Heck, I don't know.
Well, I want to get to that moment of your liberation and everything that transpired from there. But you mentioned food, and I know you lost 50 pounds or so and got down to about 125. But give us a sense of what you did have to subsist on. What kind of food did they give you? And were there moments where you got something out of the ordinary that you appreciated a lot more than you might say now?
Well, basically the food was soup and rice. In fact, it wasn't always rice. As the war went on, we didn't get rice because some sorts of grain we didn't recognize, but it was grain anyhow. And the soup was mostly vegetable soup. I'm not sure if you know what a daikon is, do you? Mm-hmm. It's a huge white radish. Yep. But we had daikon soup day after day after day. And maybe once a month you'd find a tiny piece of fish or meat in it. So the only sick problem I had is I did get beriberi. And in fact, most of the prisoners got beriberi because there was not enough vitamin B in their food. And that beriberi did have an effect on me. It's affected me ever since in my life because it affected my walking. And it used to flare up and disappear. And in the last few years, it has disappeared, so my walking is terrible.
So you told us about the food. You told us how they treated you, that you felt fortunate as an officer to be treated a little better than the enlisted men. How did you deal with not knowing when this war was going to end? And did you ever feel like it should have ended already? This is taking too long? What's going on?
No, actually, believe it or not, I predicted 4 years based on World War I. There's no connection. But somehow that was in my mind. And at our last camp up in Rokoroshi, which was very isolated, not even a small town near it. We were up there from June until the end of the war, and the food was no better, and the barracks were even worse. I sent away not so long ago a sketch of the camp that somebody had made. It's in the POW magazines and stuff. And on the upper deck, we each had 22 inches of space. On the lower deck, we each had 25 inches of space. So that's the way it is. If the war had not stopped, we probably would have frozen up there because they got snow up there all the time, and we had nothing for that. But fortunately, the war did stop.
And that's where we'll pick things up after the break. For photos relating to Jack Schwartz's story, you can pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a tribute this week to the one and only Jack Schwartz, who passed away November 7th at the age of 103. He was as sharp as ever, right up till the end, all those decades-old memories still crystal clear, like all four of the Japanese prison camps he spent time in during World War II, and the day he found out Japan had surrendered.
We were up to the camp, and the Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, here again. Hostilities have ceased, and he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there, no guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks, and it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us, and 2 hours later, and parachutes were dropping out of the camp full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much. But why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses. And this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
To kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of them anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads, and we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy, and they put the Navy people aboard the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags, and they gave us uniforms. They wore Kappa uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the planes to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. What you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. What a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us, because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody. And we stayed there for about a week and sort of got used to living again. We got all uniforms. They gave us each $100, as I recall it. And finally, we all got orders and shipped home. But we went home on a naval vessel. Here again, they didn't have room, but they built shelves. We were sleeping three deep on shelves. But this didn't matter because we were eating like pigs. And it took us 17 days to get home. And we stopped in Hawaii. Here's another funny one. The captain of the ship wouldn't let us off. He said, I will not be responsible for prisoners of war that I'm taking back to San Francisco. one of the guys on the ship was a Navy ensign, a flyer, and his father, he knew, was an admiral around Honolulu. He called him, and an hour later, we off the ship. But then we got to San Francisco.
And the captain wasn't trying to be malicious. He just didn't want to be responsible for one of you not making a home, right?
Well, that's exactly. I'm sure he thought he had to do it. I'm sure he wasn't being mean to us, but it was really. And it keeps getting funny, ha-ha. We got to San Francisco and land at Fort Mason and get off the ship. Oh, incidentally, while I was on Guam, I called my wife. I called her from Honolulu, so she was up there to meet me. What's between us and the families? A six-foot-high wooden fence. So here we are back in San Francisco. We're still prisoners. And we called each other over the fence. She told me where she was at a hotel. And then they took all of us to Oakville Naval Hospital. And we checked in there. I stayed there an hour, walked out, and thumbed a ride back to San Francisco and took a train home. Took a train home when I was home. Of course, everybody was happy to see me. But I knew I had to do something, so I went down to the Long Beach Naval Hospital, checked in there. I was reported as being AWOL, which nobody bothered about. So that was the end of my captivity.
What was it like for you, aside from talking to her over that wooden fence, when you actually got to look in your wife's eyes again and see her? Because I imagine there had to be a lot of those 1,367 days that you thought about that moment and envisioned that happening someday.
Well, we did, but I can't recall actually what we thought. Actually, I was happy I was, obviously, but I can't recall any details. We did take the train to L.A., and I was still out of uniform. I mean, practically, partly uniform. I was wearing a sweater. We had notes in our pockets to the shore patrol not to pick us up in case they did. That was about it. I stayed in Los Angeles on leave. They gave us accumulated leave and 60 days sick leave. So it wasn't until April of 46 that I actually got back on the duty. In the meantime, I was still Lieutenant J.G., and it turned out during the war, it was practically automatic promotions as the war went on, but they couldn't promote you unless you were there to sign the papers. So we didn't sign them. So about every 6 weeks, I got promoted first to lieutenant commander, then to commander. So that's why I ended up at. But
how long did you stay in the Navy?
I stayed in until 1962. I had some fantastic duties.
And I can tell you enjoyed all the duty you had, but I'm sure there's some people saying, hey, if I went in the military, ended up spending 4 years of my life as a prisoner with nothing to eat and nothing to wear and not that many people to talk to, the first thing I'd want to do is get out of the military. But you stayed in for another 17 years after World War II. What was it that you think made you do that and made you love your country and love the Navy as much as you did?
Well, as I say, when I first joined up and got my commission, I knew then a war was going to start. It would be stupid not to know it in 1940. That's why I got in. After I got out, I said, gee, I've seen the worst. Let's see what it's like. See what's good. I'd seen the bad. Yeah. And I did stay in. And as I say, I had wonderful duties, so I'm glad I did stay in. They sent me down to Key West, Florida. That was paradise. And I met my future wife down there and got married. My son was born down there. My stepdaughter, who lives here, was my wife's first child. Of course, she's still mine. I would say that duty in Key West was probably the happiest time of my life, really. Everything was wonderful there.
And then in 1962, you moved here to Hanford, and you've served as this city's director of public works. You've been the city engineer. You're still serving on the grand jury. You must like it here in Hanford a little bit.
Well, let's back up. I want to tell you about the rest of my career.
Oh, go ahead.
From Key West, I got another great duty. They sent me to just outside of Paris. I was on the staff of the, it was called UCOM, the European Command, the headquarters of all the Americans in Europe. It was called Camp Deloge. It wasn't in Paris. It was about 20 miles outside. Boy, what a break being in there for a little over 3 years. I really enjoyed that duty, too. We traveled a lot, saw all we could of Europe, at least on the western part of it. I did not make captain, so I was due to retire at 20 years, but by some quirk, I was extended for 26 years. I didn't want to retire before I left Europe because that was such good duty. So they sent me back to another good duty, which is at Flagstaff, Arizona. Down there, they were in charge of the nuclear testing up at Mercury, Nevada. And I got put in charge of a project up there. It was the first project where a nuclear weapon was discharged under granite. They were doing some testing to see what they would do before they built the headquarters there in the Rockies. And that was one of the tests to see what how things reacted in granite. After that was done, I retired and came to Hanford.
On that project, I'm curious, and I'm sure a lot of people are, what was it that you had to do, and was there some responsibility there for you that people's safety was going to depend on the work that you did to design how this was going to work?
Well, actually, I had nothing but design. It was designed many years before. But there was a tunnel. We went down 900 feet and then spread out a few hundred feet and made sort of circular tunnels and put different kinds of lining materials in. Wood, steel, soft things like styrofoam, all kinds of different linings. And when they set this nuclear device off, we went back and saw which ones were affected and how they were affected. That was the reason for the project.
So I'm sure I'm not the only one hearing you say that and saying, so they set off a nuclear device in there, and then you went back in, and people are saying, well, what about the radioactivity? So were you in these super spaceman plastic protective suits to keep the radiation out?
Absolutely not. The radiation didn't go that far. The force did, but not the radiation. In fact, they compared the radiation effect there to what's on your wristwatch. So it was really zero, as close to zero as they could get. So it was perfectly safe. While I was there, I knew I was going to retire. It took 6 months to retire, and I was looking for a job, and I was already a registered civil engineer in California. I did that while I was still working in California before the Civil War. I saw this job in Hanford, applied for it, got it, and was very happy with it, so I stayed here. It's sort of funny, I've been here over 50 years, and in my first 49 years, I traveled so much, it was such a difference. Hanford's a great place.
Hanford is a great place, and I know Hanford is happy to have you and is proud of you and should be. Couple more questions, and feel free to add anything that comes to your mind. And I have to ask this question of every veteran I interview, and especially the POWs, like your story, which is an amazing story. And I haven't gotten the sense that you're an overly sentimental guy or a really extremely emotional guy or anything like that. But I still have to ask the question. When you think about everything that you went through, everything that you survived, knowing how many others died in captivity, 30% of all prisoners held by the Japanese died, and then you think about the career that you just told us how much you enjoyed in the Navy and the fact that you got to be a father and a grandfather and do all the things you've done, that none of that would have happened had you died in captivity. How do you account for that? Do you feel like somebody was looking out for you? Is it just the way it happened? How do you think about that reality, that you survived all of that?
I just think I was lucky, that's all. I'm not an agnostic. I'm sure there's a God, but I don't believe there's a personal God. If there is one, he took care of me, I guess.
I guess the only other question I would have for you is, what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
I'm proud of the way I did my work in Hanford. I think it did a lot of good because it was pretty disorganized when I got here. And I organized it quite well, I think, and left it in good shape. So I'm proud of that.
Jack Schwartz had so much to be proud of, and they'll always be proud of his legacy in Hanford, California, where he spent the last 56 of his 103 years. Before we finish today, let's hear more from his son, Jack Jr., who 3 years ago had the opportunity to accompany his then 99-year-old dad on a cathartic journey back to Japan.
I cannot fathom. It's beyond my comprehension to try and figure out and imagine that I could have gone through what he did, much less what a lot of the other POWs in Bataan and Corregidor went through. I can't fathom it.
And that trip to Japan with him, he's 99 years old, and the two of you with some other POWs are seeing things that he probably never thought he would see. What were some of the things you experienced on that trip that made an impact?
The first major impact was coming in from the airport, because when my dad and all the other POWs had left, Tokyo and Yokohama had been devastated by the carpet bombing and the firebombing. And to a man, they were just shocked and amazed at how big and how robust Tokyo is. They had us going to the foreign ministry, and we had a really nice meeting with the deputy foreign minister and some legislators. We had a press conference, and we met with a group that does POW research, an NGO, and with students from Temple University. But one of the highlights of the trip was meeting Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy. She was so gracious. She spent a good 15 to 20 minutes with each POW, just talking. It was a highlight of the trip. But one of the parts of the trip was we broke up into groups and went to different parts of Japan. And so the group that my dad was in was with two other POWs, and we went to Yokohama. The Kawasaki 2B camp that my dad had been in, but was transferred back to Zensuchi before July of 45, was carpet bombed. And we went to the area where the Amari camp is, where Bill Sanchez was, and Louis Zamperini, and many others. Right after that, we went to an industrial plant, and a lot of the industrial plants there have rooms set aside with the history of the war and whatnot. And we went to a plant, and my dad goes, "Why are we at this plant? My guys, you know, they went to a different plant." And a woman from the NGO goes, "Well, we're going to go to your camp next." He goes, "Why? There's nothing left." He goes, "Oh, no, there's a building left." My dad goes, "Really? Well, let's go, let's go." So we went to it. I've got pictures of my dad sitting in front of this building during World War II. And sure enough, this one building is still there. That was a high point, obviously, of the trip. But when I got back to the hotel, I went to the Mansell website and pulled up a picture. And sure enough, there's that one building. Everything is devastated, but that one building is standing up there. So that's pretty neat. So Dad really appreciated that and enjoyed that. No, I'd say all of the POWs and my dad were just amazed at Japan. At some point, one of the reporters or somebody asked him, "Well, what do you think of the food in Japan?" And my dad's comment was, "Best damn food I've ever had in Japan." And after reading his diary, that adds more emphasis to it. But then we also went down to Hiroshima. That was really memorable. Went to the museum and the Peace Park and saw the one building that's still standing with the frame. It was really an amazing trip, not only from seeing what the transformation, but listening to all of the stories of the POWs, seeing my dad's reaction to things. It was an amazing trip.
Well, I got a crazy question for you, because I know your dad was way ahead of schedule on so many things. You know, the youngest kid graduating from high school, youngest guy at Caltech, youngest engineer, all these youngest. Yet he lives to 103 with a full head of hair, a full beard, and a sharp mind. Do you think that what he had to go through for close to 4 years as a POW helped extend his longevity or made him so resilient that had a hand in him living so long and so well?
I think that may have had a part to it. His side of the family has longevity, except for his father. His father passed away when he was 46 of a heart attack. But I think that the endurance that they had to summon for themselves during their times of prisoner war, I think really did have an impact on my dad afterwards. Obviously, besides physically, he had physical problems, but mentally, he kept himself busy during the camp. He learned Japanese, he taught calculus, and he always kept his mind going until the very end. And I think that it is quite possible that his experiences put him in a frame of mind that he didn't sweat the little things. You know, he was very even-keeled. He survived cancer. He survived a heart attack when he was 89 with quadruple bypass surgery. He was a survivor. And a lot of it, I think, was mental. He just kept going through it and just persevered.
Maybe that answers my last question. Anything else you want to say about your dad, feel free. But I don't think I'd be doing my job if I didn't ask you what the most important things you learned from your dad.
They broke the mold when he was born. I mean, I look at what he was able to accomplish and the love that he had for my mother and her daughter, Joan, and for me. I think it establishes a baseline for life to try and strive to. And I try and strive for it, and I don't succeed a lot of times, just in comparison to what my dad went through and what he accomplished. But my younger son calls him a beast. And, you know, he was. He respected people, and people respected him. And he was just, I mean, he was writing, he was playing Scrabble, he was just active until the very end. And for that, I'm very thankful.
When you live to be 103 and you live the way Jack Schwartz did, you compile a pretty extensive list of lives that were touched, perspectives that were altered, people who were inspired, and in Jack's case, people who are going to treasure his hand-turned wooden bowls.
I'm proud to count myself in that number and thankful for this resilient ex-prisoner of war who, even after his passing, has reminded us again today that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.